Donald Trump was off in Michigan yesterday, mostly not wearing a mask, but I want to talk about more of what he said than what he didn't do. And that's this little comment he made about Ford.
In our lifetimes, the company founded by a man named Henry Ford, good bloodlines, if you believe in that stuff, you got good blood.
Okay, so... Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking the first time I heard it. Okay, we've got stuff, but Brett, go.
There is no reason on earth for bloodlines, that word, to enter into his head, let alone come out his mouth, besides eugenics and anti-Semitism. There is no reason to think that. You say Henry Ford. What else is there? Maybe he thinks Harrison Ford is his kid? Is that what it is? Ford's filling station in Culver City, his son's restaurant that's like, meh? No. It is... I mean, if you had any doubt that this guy was a white supremacist, it's over. Like, it's over. Bloodlines is just... Aryan-centric anti-Semitism. Period.
Maybe he's watched a lot of Star Wars movies, because they seem kind of obsessed with bloodlines, which also includes Harrison Ford, of course. Maybe that's what it is.
What's the only... I can't remember if it's 1984 or Brave New World, but, like, Ford is the refrain of some, like, dystopian... future wasteland?
I don't think it's 1983. It might be Brave New World. But anyway, you probably get a little bit of that in Atlas Shrugged and stuff too. But anyway, yeah, so he seemingly ad-libbed, one would hope ad-libbed, talking about Ford in particular and then talking about bloodlines. Now, it is, as you will see, it's not that he never talks about people's bloodlines, but he does it in, like, very specific instances. And it's not common enough that you can just say the Ford thing's a coincidence or something. And here is why it's an unfortunate coincidence at best. And that is because we've got, starting in 1920, Ford's newspaper, the weekly Dearborn Independent, which was distributed through Ford dealers, that's the weirdest thing, and sent free to schools and libraries around the country, published 90 anti-Semitic articles, later collected and distributed as a book called The International Jew. That's what it looked like. You know, you get a new Ford, you get updated about an international cabal.
If you were worried about the cryptic signaling of the international Jew, let me resolve any ambiguity you might be feeling with, colon, the world's problem.
Oh, so it's not like, it's not a positive evaluation.
It's not like, oh, Jews, okay, they have frequent flyer miles. It's, no, they're a problem.
It's not
the cosmopolitan international Jew.
Okay, so I want to give people a little bit more information about Ford in particular. And the thing is, if on any given topic, if you have the option of, is Trump aware of facts or is he not aware of facts? You almost always are going to place your money on he's not aware of facts. I'm going to say, I think he's aware of some of these facts, but here you go. The collected articles that we just talked about were sold as a pamphlet, which was subsequently translated into German, and I think you know where this is going, and inspired Hitler's praise for Ford in Mein Kampf. Quote, "It is Jews who govern the stock exchange forces of the American Union. Only a single great man, Ford, to their fury, still maintains full independence." It's the rare direct quote from Mein Kampf on the show. But to give you a little bit more information about
behind the scenes, John's full of them.
To give you a little bit more information about Adolf Hitler's admiration for Ford, the wall beside his desk in Hitler's private office is decorated with a large picture of Henry Ford. And in 1938, Ford accepted the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, the Nazi regime's highest honor for foreigners, on the occasion of his 75th birthday. The two Nazi diplomats who pinned the medal on his chest also brought a personal message of congratulations from Hitler. So he had two Nazi diplomats pinning things onto him, and he liked
now,
that.
Ford is a symbol of Americana, and people who wear it proudly and aren't Chevy people who say fix or repair daily, It is a symbol of Americana because of cars and assembly lines mm-hmm. and manufacturing and open roads, right? Those people never use the word bloodline to essentially out themselves as knowing about the anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
Trump absolutely did. There is no other way to read this than he knows all this Hitler stuff. Like with Hitler, you could say bloodlines because you're criticizing Hitler because you know he's an anti-Semite, obviously. But for Ford, everybody just kind of listening, hearing bloodlines who doesn't know about Ford's anti-Semitism had to be like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of them probably understood what was going on and why he would talk about the assembly line. Talk about like the Mustang or something. The talking about the bloodlines, that's the weirdest.
It's only clanny crap.
Yeah. Imagine any conversation someone bringing up bloodlines and it's not about the Westminster Kennel Club or whatever. How weird like, that would be.
Like my high school basketball coaches would talk about bloodlines when they were like saying who their kids, their basketball players should start dating so that the kids could be taller. You know what I mean?
Well, like that's still that's weird. That's it. Just a very specific sort
it's
of weird.
It's still creepy, but it at least like it in that respect, either yeah. you're breeding dogs or you're trying to have tall kids
mm-hmm.
or you're engaging in eugenics.
Yeah.
Or advocating for its use.
Trump's obsession with bloodlines might perhaps have begun with admiring Henry Ford's contribution to the conversation, but he has made multiple references to bloodlines and genes over the years. He's repeatedly credited his position in life to, quote, good genes. In a July 2016 speech, he referenced his late uncle, a nuclear physicist, saying, Dr. John Trump at MIT, good genes, very good genes. Okay, very smart. The Wharton School of Finance, very good, very smart.
That's fine.
Uh-huh.
That's fine. I mean, that's yeah. fine. You'd say that your parents are smart, you're smart, you gotta be smart. And then I'm just talking about the way that this kind of discussion comes up
mm-hmm.
is, that's why I mentioned like Harrison Ford, maybe are any of Henry Ford's, I guess maybe, no, there's no one else out there. This isn't Fonda's. This is Ford's.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but in this situation, it's like his dad was a whatever, was a physicist. His mom was a professor. Like Steve Kerr in the documentary, like his parents are both professors. He's going to be smart either by like nature or nurture. But like in an offhanded statement, that is I'm smart because. He's not, but he's saying, I'm smart because, and my uncle was a nuclear physicist. We got good genes. With Ford, it's like this dude has good bloodlines, and the only Ford I know is him.
Mm-hmm.
Unless yeah. he was introduced by a Ford, which is possible, I guess.
Yeah. If that was the case, I would say perhaps you could again say something about the company as opposed, like, just because I meet someone's kid doesn't mean I have to talk about their bloodlines, nor have I ever, because that's bizarre. Now, really fast, let me run through just a couple more of these. This is back a trip he had done. This is in the UK. A review of a speech that he gave from someone there said, where he read, it was bad. His bits off the cuff were also a bit odd. He did have some great lines. He said, you've all got such good bloodlines in this room. That was awful. That was the script. You've all got such amazing DNA, he told a bunch of people. And he'd also said, I'm just going to quickly throw this, you remember this from earlier in the pandemic, when, again, talking about Dr. John Trump, saying that doctors want to know how he understands so much about disease and pandemics and the coronavirus. He says, maybe I have a natural ability. So, look, I mean, I guess having
that's bad. The first one, the last one, toss him out, burn the VOD. Mm-hmm. But like this, the middle one... Yes, because it underscores another, like, even the benefit of the doubt you could extend to Trump would be this. Well, either he is a white supremacist eugenicist. Yes, he loves that stuff. I mean, he is Ayn Randy. Yeah. He is, like, you know, John Galt, dumped in toxic waste with his golden hair. But the other thing is either he is talking about Henry Ford because he is a crazy eugenicist, because he's a crazy anti-Semite who wrote The International Jew, The World's Problem, or he believes in dynasties. He believes in royalty and handing down, and heirs and families that are essentially royalty, which is the opposite of what America was founded on. It's actually what America revolted against, is a system of government that yielded tyranny by handing down power from within the same family. He's an elitist at best and an anti-Semite at worst.
Yes, I agree. I disagree a little bit about the relevance of the last one. I mean, it's one thing to be like, hey, my parents are smart, I should expect that I should be smart, I guess. I don't know that the connection is necessarily as strong as some people are assuming there. But to say that because someone you are related to is smart, that you have a natural ability with all things science, so you don't have to learn, and you allow your ignorance to lead to devastating public policy consequences, to believe that you can simply slide by on your genes and have that take you through the entirety of your life, I find that to be a really horrid way to live your life. I'll also add, he made a reference once to being very happy. He made a reference once to being very happy that he has German blood. So,
I don't mind that. You need other. I'm just saying, John. You know, I'm talking. Like, yes, you need other information. You're building a case. Yes, you're building a case. Yes, I have German blood, I guess, technically.
I do. Yeah.
I mean, we're Ashkenazis. We're not Germanic. We're Ashkenazis, but Ehrlich does mean really in Yiddish and German. But
final
just
comment.
that last final comment, as it's 10:22 in the morning, is yes, he's making comments that, if taken in a broader context with a lot of people, with a lot of other statements, obviously we know about him, but just like those specific ones in. What you said about the last comment is a garbage statement. It just doesn't directly go back to eugenics. It is more of an elitist approach.
Okay, so it's a mix of the two.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joe Biden had an interview on The Breakfast Club this morning, and I want you to take a look at the last minute or so of it.
Well, you know, Thanks so much. That's really our time. I apologize.
You can't do that to black media.
I can't do that to white media and black media because my wife has to go on at 6 o'clock.
Okay.
Oh, I'm in trouble.
Listen, you got to come see us when you come to New York, VP Biden.
I will.
It's a long way until November. We got more questions.
You got more questions, but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
It don't have nothing to do with Trump. It has to do with the fact I want something for my community.
Okay, so that has generated a lot of conversation online. Obviously. That is, Brett, that was me earlier this morning watching the interview thinking, no, Joe. Stop all of it. Just stop everything. Stop. I know.
Put up the Clyburn signal.
Yeah, So I know that I criticized him many times on the show and in writing for not doing interviews. I want to take back all of those criticisms.
I mean,
please
he's
don't
had
do any more interviews.
Yeah.
He's had some fine interviews, and then he's had interviews where he yelled at Charlemagne, "If you can't decide between me, you aren't black."
That's stupid. That was a stupid way to say it, John. He didn't yell at Charlemagne.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. He just he absolutely like thought this was he was too comfortable. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, look, I get that he was joking.
The hubris of the moment. Yeah, it's hubris. It's mm-hmm. it's thinking like this is that you can make this joke when you can't. I totally still can remember in the way it sounded for a kid. Like there was a kid in our middle school who was best friends with a black kid and thought he could say the N-word. And I still think about it to this day. Ugh. And it makes me feel sick.
Yeah.
And you just can't do that. And Joe didn't say anything remotely close to that, but still it was that sense of entitlement.
Yes.
That he did not need to exercise the way he did.
Exactly. Yeah. And it seems... It seems consistent, a sort of generalized entitlement or complacency, but also a specific entitlement and complacency in that area. I want to show you another video from that, because the vast majority of the people talking about this interview are talking about that one clip, but it was an 18-minute interview, so I want to talk to you about a little bit more, not necessarily that's going to make him look much better.
I asked you about your running mate. I don't know if you saw, I saw the day that a news report broke that Amy Klobuchar was being vetted, and a lot of people on social media, they're not too happy about that. And it's because they want your running mate to be a black woman. I don't know if you saw the op-ed in the Washington Post by some of the leading black women voices in this country, and they feel since black women are such a loyal voting bloc, and black people saved your political life in the primaries this year. They have things they want from you, and one of them is a black woman running mate. What do you say to them?
What I say to them is that I'm not acknowledging anybody who is being considered, but I guarantee you there are multiple black women being considered. Multiple.
By the way, that was when the last video started. That was when
we're out of time.
The aide cut in and to say,
"That's all for tonight, ladies and gentlemen." Before we have any weird moments, we gotta get the vampire back in the coffin.
Yeah,
before the sun comes out.
Yeah, that was when it cut off. And the thing is, like, we can't go through the whole 18-minute thing, but I will tell you, there was a question that was asked to Biden, and it was like, "What are you going to do to earn these votes that you obviously need?" And you saw him there acknowledge, like, Biden's candidacy was saved by the black community, specifically black women in some of these states. And he talked for almost 2 minutes straight, not about anything he's going to do. I don't recall a single mention of policy. It was all, "I have always gotten a high percentage of the black vote. I got 96% in this election, and people said I wouldn't get it, but then in my Senate run, I got a really high percent." He wasn't asking you to reassure him, Joe, that you will get the votes. It's for you to make the case of why you should get the votes. He was given multiple opportunities, and he didn't offer anything up.
It's good work if you can get it, man.
Yeah.
Like, if you can get those votes, then get them. That was, I mean, a lot of the analysis of that is he's Obama adjacent.
Mm-hmm.
And Clyburn was like, "No, he's the real deal. I really am," you know, a prominent South Carolina black politician said, came out in the last few moments of the primaries when it was most crucial for Biden to turn the tide in the South Carolina primary. And Clyburn delivered him, and then the Democratic Party delivered every other moderate in the universe. That was the time the tides turned, and he got the votes. And a lot of the reason, it seems, from the analysis I've read and from talking to various people, is that it's just, I just want it to get somewhat back to the way it was before, because this is impossible.
Yeah.
And the time when Obama was the president was better for me than the time that is now. And a lot of people, when they're analyzing how they want the world to be from a political perspective, like, they're busy. They have a lot of stuff going on, and they read the news that they see, and you and I read a million different kinds of news, and for us, you're making a policy-based argument, and it seems like you got to make it better. Whether that is finding a way around the corporate media slant or making a different argument to get through to more people or making this argument for a longer period of time to push the discourse the direction it has been going. Right now, you got the polling on Medicare for All. You got the polling on free college. You got the polling on all the progressive party platform policy initiatives. Now you need to connect that to votes. That's the challenge. That's the thing we got to do better, and we got to solve that puzzle.
I agree. It's going to be a large portion of what we talk about going forward is trying to figure that out. Right now, I am trying to appeal to Biden for his own sake. Like maybe you've even seen good internal reasons to believe that you can just skate by. I would say, how about just in case?
But he's done it. So the big Rorschach test is he doing it just to seem like he's appealing to people, or is he genuinely trying to build that coalition? Because he did after having one position on bankruptcy and student loans, mm-hmm. he changed that position. Mm-hmm. He did put AOC and progressives on his unity coalition.
And we did a video about
and
that.
And we did a video, but and we did. And it's and those
and
are
I tweeted about his rent stuff. Got a lot of hate for acknowledging everybody, that he said that.
Everybody yesterday went crazy on Cenk, and our poll, which was about which frontrunner you want, when they were like, I want Nina Turner. And it's like, yes, we all want Nina Turner. The question is a little different than that. Like, mm-hmm. what are we going to do given the circumstances? I know that one part of it is we just got to keep fighting the fight. But the other one is, how do you fight the fight given where we are right now? And that is a more difficult, nuanced, strategic conversation versus one that the polling already says that we're winning on, which is just the polling's showing that we're winning on, which is just how people feel about stuff. We need to connect the dots in people's minds. And unfortunately, you got to run through corporate media, which is trying to preserve their ad sales people's revenue streams.
Yeah. Look, I want to end with a statement that was sent to Mediaite by Charlemagne about the interview. And I went on his Twitter, and some of his tweets about it imply that he thinks at least that some people are taking that last comment as like what the interview was, and he doesn't think it was representative of the full interview. So if you found it interesting, please watch the entirety of the interview. It is available. But here is a statement that he said. We have been loyal to Democrats for a long time. Black people have invested a lot into that party, and the return on investment has not been great. As Biden said in our brief interview, when I asked him if Dems owe the black community, absolutely was his answer. So let's see what you got. Votes are quid pro quo. You can't possibly want me to fear Trump more than I want something for my people. So that's his view.
That is the I haven't seen it written so clearly before.
Yes.
That is great.
For some time now, Fox hosts have been saying you need to get back to work. And more importantly, you all want to get back to work. You all want to go back. And the government is being tyrannical by stopping you. And they've also been playing down the threat of the virus. And the thing is, if you're going to sell the message, people need to go back and also imply that it's not nearly as deadly as people thought, that social distancing and quarantining isn't necessary, as Tucker Carlson did a big segment on literally last night, then it seems to undercut your argument when you are saying that from your nice mansion in upstate New York, I would think. And I would say that they seem to have gotten that message, at least on Fox and Friends, because this morning Steve Ducey had this to say.
Nonetheless, it's just a sign of frustration where people have had it up to here. We're sick of being closed. We're ready to move on. But, you know, Ainsley, Brian, you and all of us are in really restrictive areas right now. And that's why we are not all sitting together on the couch or even in the same studio, because mm-hmm. the governments won't let us right now.
Yeah, there is nobody in Manhattan. And for those people who are critical of us, because we should be reopening at a much quicker pace. This is a hot spot. There's nothing here. One of the safest places to be is New York City because they cleared everybody out.
Okay, so they're only broadcasting from home because the government won't let them broadcast from the studio. And then Kill Me doubles down and says, it couldn't be safer here. So first, Brett, hold. What Ducey said is not true at all. Per a New York State executive order, news media have been deemed essential personnel, and they are permitted to leave their home for work purposes. The hosts of Fox and Friends are under no legal obligation to remain in place. And that is basically the case in every state across the country. If we wanted to, we could go broadcast from home, but we're not trying to convince people that there's no threat from studio. But we're not sitting here saying you definitely want to go back and it's safe to go back. We don't think it necessarily is at this point, which is why we're not rushing back to the studio.
I'm not jumping into a shark's mouth because the government won't let me. No, that's not it. That's not it.
He just
lied. It's so stupid. He just lied to you. He lied to you, and in that is a is the essential lie of Fox News. It is pretending to be one of you, mm-hmm. despite the facts on the ground. That's it. He's pretending to be like that assembly worker who isn't going to work. And he wants to complain the same way he wants to put out the impression that he is a victim, the way other actual victims are victims. And that is what Fox News does day in and day out. And they're just not. Like, how are you trying to empathize with the plight of someone who is forced to stay home, who wants to advocate that they are an essential worker, when you are staying home voluntarily, yeah. because they're trying to protect you.
Yeah. And they could go in with a skeleton crew. And here's the thing.
There's probably someone in the studio right now.
They probably are. The fact that they're not doing that tells me a lot, because they are savvy enough to know that if they were to go in with a skeleton crew, it would buttress their argument, or at least it would seem to. It would seem to imply that things are safer and that they're being consistent. But even knowing the potential upside to doing it, they still don't do it, which indicates to me that they are very much aware of the threat and that they are rightfully and understandably worried about catching a potentially fatal illness.
And so, here's what's... Well, I just want to say, like, if they got sick, I'm sure they'd sue Fox News. Mm-hmm. At the same time that they're advocating for protections from corporations to be sued by their employees if the employees are forced to come back to work too soon and do get sick.
100%. Now, I don't know exactly what happened right after Ducey and Kilmeade had that little conversation, but I do know that something must have happened, because at some point, Ducey decided he needed to just amend what he had said a little bit.
Country slowly reopens. You know, I mentioned earlier we were broadcasting from separate remote locations. I said, because the government won't let us. I need to clarify. We are simply following the government protocols and guidelines. And ultimately, if you are lucky enough that you can work from home, you should.
Okay, so he admits they're under no obligation whatsoever. We're just following the advice of government. The government says, sure, you could go back, but it's probably not safe to, because you could die from coronavirus. And that, to me, a millionaire who can sit in my house, seems very reasonable. But all the rest of you should ignore that, and you should get out there and go back to sports things and Trump rallies and all that stuff.
Yep, that's so stupid. And then there's a little bit of something that we're going to get into with garbage people at the end, where Kilmeade, at the end of the first clip, said essentially wants to, he says it's super safe. The reason it's safer now, essentially, is because of all these things you're complaining about.
Yeah.
Like, you can't have the safe and the lack of social distancing at the same time.
Yeah.
And I get it, man. It's so frustrating. Like, we all know these things, you idiot. You dingus. Everybody knows that it's dangerous. Everybody knows that these are very annoying constraints put on people's emotions. We also know that your team is lying about it. And we all know that we need to find the right equilibrium here. We're doing it responsibly, and you'd rather just complain about it as part of your grift.
Yeah. Yeah. And just two quick things. One, He seemed to acknowledge at the end there, Ducey, that if you're lucky enough to work from home, you should. But I think sort of a necessary additional thought to that is, so what about the people who aren't lucky enough? Why should they have to throw themselves into the shark's mouth, as Brett said? What if there was an alternative? What if the government could help them? Why is that not even a topic of conversation, the possibility that they could be helped so that they don't have to for a little bit?
Yeah.
And I want to give a little bit of credit to Ainsley Earhart, who I don't often give credit to. She, after the Kilmeade thing, I don't remember exactly what she said, and I don't know what her position is on social distancing and all that, but she seemed to indicate that she was saying that Kilmeade was wrong, that it is still, there's, you know, a lot going on in New York and it's potentially dangerous. She also said a lot of people can't leave because they can't, they don't have two homes. And then she like paused and said, most people don't. Yeah. Good catch.
You do. Most people don't. The only reason she's saying that is because this is the safest time to fly, isn't it, Ainsley? Because she caught so much flak.
That's true. That's true.
After she made the mistake.
Yeah.
And like they've been irresponsible the entire way. Yeah. And it's so strange to me that like rather than understand the reason, like the full implications of why they got the blowback, they'd rather just kind of technically be accurate without really understanding the spirit of what they should be saying.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I try to give her credit, but you're right. She was 100% wrong about that. It's the best time to fly.
Oh, it's the God. Safest time to fly, she said.
Yeah,
even it's more, the safest even more. Time to
yeah,
fly.
Best.
And, but like these yeah. are the people that we put in charge of discourse in America.
Yeah, they get so many viewers every day. Economically, these past few months have been very rough for the vast majority of Americans. But the past month or so has seen some improvements among a certain type of people. America's billionaires saw their fortunes soar by $434 billion during the U.S. lockdown between mid-March and mid-May. The net worth of America's billionaires grew 15% during the two-month period from $3.382 trillion from $2.948 trillion. Now, really fast, before we get into the specifics, and the specifics are mind-boggling, this does not mean, as some people are implying, that they all are doing much better than they were before coronavirus was a thing. Some are, and some significantly are. For the vast majority, it is that they have largely recovered from the drops in the stock market before the lockdowns. So let's be clear about that. But they are recovering very fast. And we're going to have specifics, but Brett, I want to give you an opportunity to jump in.
Yes, they have either... They've been insulated from any of the negative effects and or they've been able to solidify their position as wildly scaled market share owners because like look at Bezos, for example. Bezos has the solution in a time when you can't go to the store down the street.
Yeah,
that's and true. In the meantime, so for people like him, the store down the street closes. So you even after this is over, you can't go to the store down the street.
Yeah.
Right. And this and in terms of the stock market, Mitch McConnell is signaling this today, yesterday, and really for the last 15 to 20 years, but specifically here. And then in the wake of the 2008 crash, the priorities of the federal government's response to giant disasters that ravage economies is not to save the people. It's to save the companies. And so that's what they've done. And the stock market, as much as we want to say that they're like these badass Gordon Gekko types, they're scared little mice. And so the government goes to great extremes, or cockroaches really, to keep the lights off. Just let you guys run around and do it. Don't worry, we'll never turn on the lights and expose how skittish you are. Because if there's a little light that gets into that room, if we expose, like, look at how high the unemployment is. And so essentially they have signaled since the 2008 crash that they will take care of the corporations and they will not, like, in the meantime, help mom and pop shops stay open. Yeah. Like what it takes, I know people who have these small business loans and it's a nightmare. They go back and forth multiple times. It took forever to get approved. Once they get approved, they have to submit their plan for how it's going to work. And the rules have kept changing along the way for small businesses.
Yeah. Well, some of these people we're going to talk about are the largest of businesses. So let me just run through some of these stats. The biggest gains were at the top of the billionaire pyramid with the richest five billionaires, Bezos, Bill Gates, Zuckerberg, Warren Buffett, and Larry Ellison, seeing combined wealth gains of $76 billion. That's five billionaires. Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg had the biggest gains, with Bezos adding $34.6 billion to his wealth and Zuckerberg adding $25 billion. Elon Musk had the largest percentage gain, or among the largest, seeing his net worth jump by 48% in 2 months to $36 billion. Zuckerberg went up by 46%, Bezos by 31%. So I know that, like, you might think by watching Elon Musk's continued devolution on social media that things are getting worse and worse for him, but he has been re-raking it in at the very least over the past month or so, even right, without being able to get back to work.
He's not he's not crazy because of the desperation. He's crazy because we keep feeding him more money and he feels more powerful and less hinged.
Exactly. Yeah. I just recently saw Spirited Away, and it's basically what happened to No Face. They fed it and it got worse and more awful. And the reason that I point this out is, again, it's not the case that just billionaires are doing 30% better than they were in December 2019 or anything like that. But the thing is that even before most of the country goes back to normal and starts to recover, the best off have recovered and in fact are doing better than they were 2 months ago, basically. Not everyone has. Things like you talked about the cockroaches, like getting nervous and stuff like that. And so stock prices drop, but then they go back up once people are less nervous and all of that. Like if you lost wages for 2 months, you don't just magically get them back once people are confident again. And so the recovery is already happening for some people. It's not even close to starting to happen for the people at the bottom. That's why I wanted to cover this.
They have faith. Yeah, they have. Right. Exactly. They have faith that that this will be over. And the companies who are not the companies that fail are the ones that aren't public, that aren't publicly traded, period.
It's the end of the week and it is time to take out the trash. Okay, Brett, you're up first. Who's your garbage person of the week?
There's a lot of COVID Karens out there, but there is a more recent one that is a specific. I don't think she's as bad as the Karens who actively cough on people, so there's a caveat there. But like the specific path her neuroses take, this is the garbage Karen.
Let's take a look.
It was probably 45 minutes of having it on. It's the first time I've worn one. I am disoriented. I'm a little mad, if you can't tell that already. Like, I'm frustrated that I don't feel good physically. Like, I can tell you right now, I wasn't getting enough oxygen. And I just had on one of these little stupid things. I feel dizzy. My hands are kind of tingly. My heart is beating fast, so some of it's an emotional reaction, but some of it's a physical reaction. I understand the virus is real, okay? I understand the virus is real. Friends, look at the numbers and tell me why everybody's living in fear. Tell me why we're putting these things on and not being able to breathe. I just want to cry. Like, that's all I want to do is cry, because you can't see people's faces. You can't make human connection. We can't hug people. We can't hold their babies.
That's it.
Okay. Well, wow, your reaction. Look, obviously I'm opposed to her, but I have this natural sort of progressive-y thing where when I see a person crying, I naturally start to feel bad for them. Even if
no, dude. No. And here's
I'm
why.
I'm not saying overall, but I'm saying
the
end.
Get out of free card. It's okay. When she says she's mad, she's smiling.
Yes, that's true.
Because the specific Karen she is one where that brings her joy.
Yeah.
It's the uncanny ability to find misery in an otherwise fine situation. Mm-hmm. Like, I get it. It's not easy. We all know it's not easy. We all have to find other ways to have human connection. And I do understand that people need an outlet in these times, and sometimes that outlet, like yesterday, I was so frustrated that I went and took a walk and put my headphones in and had a conversation with no one to just sort it out.
Yeah.
I'm sharing that with you because I feel comfortable and I know I'm an insane person, but I didn't go. And in that moment where I'm like crying, be like, I can't hold babies. Like, that, what a weird thing to get to. Like, whose babies are you holding? And someone in your condition, I don't think, should be holding babies.
Oh, jeez. Look, I agree. She didn't make the video because she happened to be wearing the mask and this stuff happened and she thought, oh my God, I got to make a video about this. She wanted to make a video. They all want to make videos about how they're mad and how their rights have been taken away because there is a very strong appeal to feeling like you're a victim. That's the projection from the right that, like, it's all, like,
harder.
It's gay people and it's whatever, like, that they say are playing the victim Olympics. No, there's no one who likes being a victim more than a relatively affluent, white, straight person.
When the head of your religion is a martyr, mm-hmm. that happens.
Yeah, that's not a bad point. And here's what I will say. Is wearing a mask uncomfortable? Sure. Does it make you dizzy from lack of oxygen? Nope.
No.
It doesn't. You are just lying about that. And there was a state rep, a Republican, who was like, I have 12 studies that show that wearing a mask like this causes respiratory problems. And they reached out to some of the authors, and the author's like, no, we're talking about people being on, like, air supplies. Like, we're not talking about masks, PPE. They're just lying because they understand that just saying, it makes me look stupid, that you don't have the moral high ground. So they have to pretend that it's a threat to their health. It is not a threat to their health under normal circumstances.
But that is a very essential part of the strange alchemy of Karenhood. Like, part
that's
of
a book
that
I want to read.
The magic sauce is stuff like when she says, if you look at the numbers, is it real? There's 100,000 dead people. And that's with all the restrictions that are in place that you're complaining about. So you have confirmed they exist. You confirm that they have changed the normal behavior of people so that the arc of this thing isn't the way it would have been if we had kept behaving normally.
Yeah. How many people would be dead if we had gone along with what, you know, Trump's initial knee-jerk reaction was?
And then
if
just
100,000 died after all this.
And just the final thing is, like, I know the virus is real, and I know that, like, I'm having my hands shake and my heart's beating faster, and, like, some of these are mental, and some of these are physical, though. No, you don't know that they're physical. You don't know that they're physical. They are – all the things that you described are a panic attack. Mm-hmm. Like, everything you did. My heart's beating faster. I'm having trouble breathing. And that's in your mind, and I totally understand that. But, like, don't blame it on coronavirus. Yeah. Blame it on you and find a way to make it through. That should be your focus. Your focus should not be on, well, now I have a get out of handling this crisis free card because I had a panic attack when a mini panic attack when I put my mask on. Find a way to put your mask on and keep America safe that doesn't result in you having a panic attack rather than trying to say, listen, I want to hold babies. You can stop all of this.
Well, look, if you're actually genuinely having a hard time, I understand it. It's very difficult. A lot of people probably have it far harder than me, and I'm having a tough time. It is getting more difficult. I get that. The solution is not F all the scientists. And it's not even just let's go back out there. It's I want everyone to go back out there, and I don't want them to wear masks. It's like, it's not enough to just say I want an end to the lockdowns. It's, I want an end to the lockdowns, and I will take it as a personal affront if literally anything is done to stop the transmission of this virus.
And just to put a little button on my invective of Jesus, he was crucified. You have to wear a mask.
Yeah, similar.
There's a difference.
That's similar.
You're not that.
For my garbage person of the week, I have someone who we have talked about, but I have updates. It is this individual. That's a nice little picture of Mike Pompeo. Why is he doing that pose? No one knows. But his next pose will be in the trash, and I would like to explain why. It isn't just for all of the reasons concerning the firing of Steve Linick last Friday that we've already talked about. The possibility that he was investigating the emergency for the Saudi arms deal and all that. It's not just the Madison dinners for 500 people that were apparently done for his personal political interests. It's not just for using the aid and everything. It's for new stuff, too. So we have updates to some of those, as well as new information. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo pushed State Department officials to find a way to justify that emergency declaration that he'd already decided to implement in order to fast-track the $8 billion in arms sales. So it wasn't just that they did it, it's that he then tried to get his underlings to find some rationale for why they had to do it, and now they're starting to talk, with one State Department official telling CNN they seem to have a game plan and it had to be justified. And that person said that they had communicated to the State Department's Office of the Inspector General during an interview late last year as part of the investigation into Pompeo's move to fast-track the sale. So they were very uncomfortable about this entire thing and communicated it to the person who theoretically might have been fired as a result of that. But it's not just that. It's not just the private jets, and it's not just the Madison dinners. It's other special secretive trips that he took on our dollar for his political ambitions. He apparently made a secretive trip in January to a Florida retirement enclave populated by prominent Republican donors while on the tail end of a diplomatic trip to Latin America, leading one to wonder if that trip was even necessary, or if it was a pretext to go to Florida. He held the same kind of quiet meeting in December with Republican donors over a hotel dinner on a State Department trip to London. And last October, he huddled with Charles G. Koch, the Republican billionaire and a longtime supporter of his, while on an official visit to Kansas. That trip was made aboard a government aircraft. In each of these instances, Mr. Pompeo did not put the visits on his public schedule. We sort of understand why. Because the office is for him.
Yeah. I used to like Mike Pompeo, and now I don't.
Yeah.
I used to think he was a swell guy, and now it seems like he's an evil, evil man who's only... And God, he makes me so sick. He makes me so sick because of, like, the way he just stares people down and lies. Or stares people down and knows, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. Yeah, look, It's one thing for him, like many politicians, and especially we've seen a lot of these cabinet-level positions under Trump, believing that the office is there for them to just spend the money and use the personnel for errands and stuff like that, whatever they want, just personally. It would be one thing if he was also having a positive impact on our diplomatic position, helping to rein in Trump, that sort of thing. He doesn't seem to be doing that. Trump just pulled out of another treaty, one that was hoping to forestall future wars. So did he talk to Trump about that? He didn't seem to have much of an effect if we're just pulling out of treaties at a rate of like one every 6 months at this point. And so he's in a position of power. We should be able to have minimal expectations. He can't even meet those because of a combination of personal corruption, personal ambition, and deference to the will of Donald Trump.
I don't think it's deference to the will of Donald Trump. I think he's playing Donald Trump in a way to benefit himself. The deference is not, but I think that's something that can be used against him to have him viewed in a more negative light by Donald Trump. Like he is using the position Trump gave him to enrich himself and work counter to what Trump does because he wants to raise his own profile in the future. He's looking past Trump. He's looking past the Trump White House. He is shoring up right now. The things he's doing now, he shouldn't be doing now. If he believed in Donald Trump, if he believed he was going to do everything that would help Donald Trump get reelected, he wouldn't be making Kansas Senate-run financing trips right now. Mm. Like, yeah. He is looking to exit. He is looking to use Trump as that little thing in the pole vault, the little thing you stick your pole in and launch yourself up. So basically...
It's probably a technical term.
Yeah, Mike Pompeo is sticking his pole right in Trump's little nook, if you know what I mean, and trying to launch himself onto this soft pad.
Okay, third garbage person is Brett. Brett, get in there. Okay, so that's my garbage person. But as always, we close out the week by asking you who you think best exemplified live in a garbage life. And so we want to tell you what we got there. This is always available at the, usually on Thursdays, on the TDR YouTube community tab. Angel puts up a poll, and 13,000 plus of you responded to this. And let's see what we've got. Mike Pompeo got 13%, Bill Barr at 3%, Moscow Mitch at 6%, and Karen Spreadin' Karen at 13%. So... Oh, and I also wanted to give a shout-out to user eKrenz, who suggested Karen Spreading Karen 19 for the community garbage people. We do appreciate that. So, my pick and Brett's pick tied for your pick of the week. That's never amazing. Happened before.
That is amazing.
I know. And that is the glory and power of not having Trump on for 1 week. Because otherwise he would have... All of the above, by the way, probably means Trump. But anyway, he'll be back next week. Don't worry. But anyway, thank you to everybody who voted. 13,000 of you. That's a lot. After close to months of dragging their feet, things are now starting to accelerate in the Ahmaud Arbery case. And joining us now to talk about some of the most recent developments, we have the former director of the Democratic Party of Georgia and a radio talk show host of the Rashad Ritchie Morning Show. Rashad, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. Wish we could be talking about something a little bit less dark and tragic. But there have been, as I alluded to, some recent developments. Can you talk to us about those?
Yeah, so the third individual who videotaped, who recorded this massacre, this murder, has now been arrested by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Now, I've said this before, that if you follow the actual Georgia law, he should have been arrested at the scene of the crime. And the individual, they call him Roddy. His full name is William Roddy Bryan Jr., 50 years of age, was the vehicle behind Travis and Gregory McMichael. On the video, you can see Travis McMichael pull the trigger multiple times with his shotgun and his dad, Gregory McMichael, take aim, obviously, just in case his son missed. But it was Roddy, or William Roddy Bryan, who decided to record. And in the police report actually indicates that he was part of a criminal posse in order to trap or to basically illegally detain Ahmaud Arbery. So it was the police report that has been the damning piece of evidence. And the police report was given by way of Gregory McMichael and Travis McMichael. They're the ones who said that Roddy Bryan was part of this.
Yeah, so what I'm interested in is, I know that some people responded by saying, well, he's not one of the shooters, but obviously he's there. And people are saying that he helped to sort of box Ahmaud in, scare him as they continue to chase him for multiple minutes. But we also know that it doesn't seem like perhaps much would have happened if the video hadn't come out. Is the idea that perhaps he might have released it to protect himself, to put more of the blame onto the other two? Why do you think he released the video, even though he is now a part of this?
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. As a matter of fact, when his attorney came out and said, we're the ones who leaked this video, they did it in order to protect Roddy Bryan, or William Roddy Bryan, and to potentially exonerate Gregory McMichael and Travis McMichael. And I don't know why they thought this would exonerate
that
them in
insane.
Some way. It's insane, but thank God for redneck logic, because only redneck logic would apply here. So they released a clip of this video thinking somehow it did not show a murder, and it did. But Georgia law is very clear. And I find it really ironic that as soon as the law, as soon as the statute is contrary to the narrative, the statute is no longer talked about. There's a Georgia statute that says very clearly, if you are in commission of a felony, and in this case, the felony is basically trying to illegally detain a citizen. But if you are in commission of a felony and somebody ends up dying while you're in commission of that felony, it doesn't matter if you pull the trigger or not. You will be charged with felony murder. The GBI got it right, and the local DA got it wrong.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, as this has been developing, we've also had a number of different stories come out about Ahmaud, like clockwork, as expected, delving into his past, trying to find, did he trespass? Did he shoplift once? Did he not tie his shoes? Like, they go through social media and they go through all of this, seemingly to imply at some point that this person no longer deserves your compassion for having been brutally murdered in this way. Are you surprised that once again has been sort of the reaction to this becoming a big case, that you got these sorts of stories coming out?
Hail to the no, I'm not surprised. I knew this was going to come as soon as he was a victim of murder. Why? Because there's a public narrative that suggests somehow blackness deserves to die, or there has to be a reason based on the past of Ahmaud Arbery why Gregory McMichael and Travis McMichael pursued him and killed him. Here's the bottom line. All of those instances have absolutely nothing to do with the criminal act that was done against Ahmaud Arbery. It is simply a way to muddy the waters, to create a public relations campaign against the deceased. Let's be very clear. The victim is dead. The victim is 6 feet underground. The ones who killed him are going on trial, not the victim. But we have seen this happen time and time again. And we keep saying that the videos are surfacing as if they're magically appearing. Yeah. These videos are not magically appearing. This is an intentional campaign with individuals actually bringing these videos up to the forefront to make themselves look justified. And that's what you see happening. It is sad. It is disgusting, but to be expected.
Yeah, there was one example of that from one of the early videos that came out. I think it was when the possibility that Ahmaud had been at that construction site briefly. I think you lashed out at Candace Owens for sort of implying that, oh, well, this is case closed, that clearly they've got him now because he went to that place. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Candace Owens obviously being insanely ridiculous in her commentary, so much so that even Black Republicans have now disowned her. Said that, oh, he's a burglarer that went into a property. Well, now we know that there was not a string of burglaries. We also know that when he went to that property, allegedly went into that property, there was no crime committed. Even Larry English, the owner of the property, said no burglary took place. There was no crime committed. There's also current state law. There's current case law, excuse me, that speaks to what a burglary actually is, which means a dwelling place. The word dwelling is legally significant because it means that at least at some point there's an occupant at the property, commercial property or residential property. If there's no occupancy at the property and there's no breaking of a seal like a window or a door, then the crime of burglary cannot be committed,
yes.
Which means that there was no way a felony was committed in the presence or even outside of the presence of anyone, which also means by connection, there was no justification to track down Ahmaud Arbery, commit to a citizen's arrest, and kill him in the process.
Yeah, and even if he had committed crimes at that site, there'd be no justification whatsoever for the brutal murder that they clearly had been planning for, the fact that they brought the guns at all. Actually, and somewhat related to that, I'm not sure if you were familiar with yesterday, Sean King, he tweeted about the fact that some sort of neighborhood text messages had been leaked to him, that there had been this communication going on in the area, sort of implying that something needed to be done. I haven't seen the actual messages yet, so I don't know exactly what they'll show, but it makes me wonder if possibly more people might end up being drawn into this, if other people had been sort of goading these individuals to track down and, you know, assault the person that they thought was responsible. Do you think that there's any likelihood of that?
I think there is a likelihood. And remember, there was a Glenn County police officer who sent a text message to the owner of the property in question, Larry English, who lives 2 hours away from Glenn County. And in that text message, this cop basically deputizes Gregory McMichael, someone who was not post-certified as a cop, someone who was no longer a cop, someone who does not have arrest powers. So this cop decided to de facto deputize Gregory McMichael and say, hey, if you have any problems, you call Gregory McMichael. He didn't say call 911. Yeah. He didn't say call the police. He said call Gregory McMichael. And there's this sense of a neighborhood mob almost being created because of this. And I think you're right. There's a level of premeditation here because even in the police report, according to Gregory McMichael's words, he simply yelled to his son, he's running down the street, and they grabbed guns, got in the pickup truck, and they started to pursue him. Well, if I tell somebody he's running down the street and everybody knows what to do, yeah, that means we planned it. That's premeditated.
True. That's true. And, you know, while this is the case that we're talking about, it is tragically not the only case of its sort that we'll likely to see even in that area, even around this time. And I know that you, as the editor-at-large of Rolling Out Magazine, you're planning to help to spotlight more cases like this. What are you hoping that campaign might accomplish?
Man, we already have about 20 cases that we're looking at right now. But basically, the state of Georgia has been riddled over the last few decades with suspicious murders of unarmed Black men and Black women that have gone unresolved or not prosecuted by the local authorities. We are now going to look into those extrajudicial killings and expose them. Rolling Out Magazine has a readership monthly of 2.2 million, a combined social media following of roughly 400,000. So we're able to get a message out to the forefront. And what we've seen in this case is how the media is effective and how the media can impact a story being told the right way. And that's what we plan to do. And we're partnering with organizations like the local NAACP and others to bring those stories to the forefront.
Well, that is certainly a lovely goal, and I hope that people pay attention to it. Rashad Ritchie, thank you so much for joining us and breaking down this really important case.
Thank you for having me.
The particular type of government that Donald Trump runs, it's dangerous in the best of times, and it's been months since we are in anything even approaching the best of times. And so I wanted to check in with a guest we've had on a couple times before to see how Trump's movement, philosophically, ideologically, how it's constituted, how that is influencing the response to the pandemic, and how members of his base are viewing the response to that pandemic. So I'm very happy to welcome to the show once again Jacob Urofsky, professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, John. Always great to be here.
Glad to have you here. We've talked about your book before. The updated paperback version is going to be available this coming week, just a couple of days after this video is made available. So congratulations on the soft cover, first of all.
Thank you. I wish it weren't needed.
Yeah, that's 100% true. But we're not at that time yet. So let's talk about fascism. And we had Donald Trump and his movement presiding for a few years. Now we're in the middle of, you know, the greatest domestic emergency that we've had in our lifetime. What are some of the thoughts that you've been having as you've watched the way Trump has responded to all of this?
So if you look at the international situation, and you with Trump, Bolsonaro in Brazil, with Vladimir Putin in Russia, and then you have Modi in India, all of whom are ethno-nationalists to some degree or other, all of whom have authoritarian tendencies, all of whom practice what I would call fascist politics. They're macho, strong men who trust their guts over science and reason and vilify their enemies as communists and socialists and demand just that the attention is fully on them and see themselves as infallible. Well, these are the countries with the worst responses to the pandemic. These are the countries whose leaders, and Trump foremost among them, or maybe Bolsonaro in Brazil foremost among them, have discarded the dictates of science, have declared themselves infallible, and are facing the worst of the coronavirus crisis, because reality is not your enemy, it's just there. But in this kind of politics, there's only friend and enemy.
Yep, there's already so many things I want to ask you. So this is what's confused me, is I would sort of get, if Donald Trump, who doesn't trust scientists or expertise of any kind, if he just felt that they were all wrong and thought it's not going to be that bad, then I sort of get how he could stupidly blunder into this horrendous response. But I wonder why didn't he have at least the forethought to realize that if he had been able to ward off the worst of the coronavirus, if he had actually been the protector of the American people that he presents himself as, it feels to me like he would have been a lock for re-election, that it would be in his own personal interest to do that, and yet he didn't. So why exactly? Is it just based on not trusting what the experts were saying?
Well, this mindset or ideology, and my work is not really about regimes. It's about the ideology or the mindset of someone who practices fascist politics. That ideology is reality resistant. It views, it just says there are friends and there are enemies, and it denies anything. The person who practices this politics denies anything that is that they don't want to believe. They, you know, so the pandemic posed a crisis. It posed a crisis, a difficult crisis, and it was hard to see that the crisis was going to involve a hit on one's popularity, a hit on one's favorability. So the mindset of this kind of leader is going to deny that it even exists, and then it's going to politicize the situation, so that if you do think it exists, you too are an enemy.
Yeah. You know, you've mentioned here, and we've talked in the last time we spoke about us versus them and how it's about dividing groups and things like that. Early on, Trump was, he was pretty positive when he would speak about the government response to the pandemic. But even early on, before the death count started to really skyrocket, there was this attempt on the right, primarily on Fox News, to fight back by declaring that we have to call this the Chinese virus or the Wuhan virus or whatever. It's not racist. We just think it's important that we point out who it is. And Trump has had a couple of very racially charged interactions with reporters who are either Asian American or he believes female, might be Asian. Exactly.
Female.
Exactly. That's a very good point, too. Universally female. Is that part of this? Is the need to maybe distract the American people by focusing on China? Should we expect more of that?
So this is a move that Trump is very good at making, to transfer something, to distract by raising the culture wars. So you might think that the use of the Chinese virus is the phrase the Chinese virus is a dog whistle. But I don't think it's a dog whistle. I think the politics works differently here. What he's doing is he's saying, okay, so the Chinese virus, that can mean different things. It's crucially, it's ambiguous, right? It can mean the China, the virus that came from China, although the Spanish flu came from, I think, the United States somewhere. But it can mean the virus that came from China, the virus that was foisted on the world by China, the virus associated with Chinese people. It can mean any of those things. So what Trump is doing is he's seeking to provoke a culture war. It's intentional. It was intentional to distract us from the incompetence of his administration's response. He wanted to provoke people into calling him racist. Mm-hmm. So then he could say, look at the liberals. They're calling us racists again when I just meant this. And so so it changes the topics to the culture war. And that's one of President Trump's signature moves to distract. When you've got an issue like the competence in a crisis, shift it to the culture wars, get the liberals to call you a racist, have plausible deniability. I just meant the virus that came from China. And then your supporters are like, and then you say to your supporters, see, they're calling us racists again.
Yeah.
And then no one remembers your initial response.
Well, and my knee-jerk reaction would be to say, well, you can't deny the numbers. You can't deny 93,000 dead already. But it appears that some of them can deny those numbers and are going to increasingly gymnastic efforts to pretend that the numbers aren't serious or they're not as bad as you think. So the distraction, if you combine that with the fact that many of his base probably have a warped view of what the response was and what the cost has been so far, should we expect that completely bungling this thing might not be a huge danger to his reelection that you would otherwise assume, that if you have this emergency and you fail in your response to it, that people would throw you out of office? Is there less of a chance of that because of the ideological nature of his movement?
There's less of a chance of it. And it also depends on unpredictable facts about the near-term future. For example, the initial phases of the virus fit along patterns I discuss in the book, How Fascism Works. So chapter 9 of that book is called Sodom and Gomorrah. It's about how fascist politics involves vilifying the cities, representing the cities as full of disease, filled with foreigners who bring disease. Trump has relentlessly used this to further his own ideological agenda of attacking cities as disease-ridden, of attacking immigrants. So very early on, they've consistently tried to link immigration, even legal immigration, to the disease, even though the United States is a place where has the worst problem anywhere in the world right now. So they've consistently used it to further that very ideological agenda. So the more that he can link the coronavirus and disease, which in the fascist imaginary is linked to foreigners anyway, the more he can link that to immigrants, the more it fits into this ideological framework, the more he can link it to Black and Hispanics, Hispanic residents in the United States, citizens and residents who are in any case suffering more because they are the essential workers.
Yeah.
The more he can do that, the more it fits into the ideological framework of the kind of fascist politics he wants to run. And I think he's done a very successful job of convincing many of his supporters that it's a disease that poses less of a risk for them and more of a risk for urban dwellers, minorities, and immigrants. Mm. And let's not forget that. So the near future, if the disease makes significant inroads into his base, then we might see an effect in terms of his support. But I suspect that will happen. But I think ideology can take you quite far. So far he's been milking it to say, look, I said close the borders. Look, I said disease. And when you think disease, don't you think minorities? Because that's what he's trying to do. This kind of politics involves making that kind of fallacious link.
There's one other thing I want to ask you about, and I'm sure that it is, as we talked about earlier, it is being used as a bit of a digression. It's used as a bit of a distraction. But the whole thing about the masks, the fact that Donald Trump refuses to wear one, doesn't want to be photographed in one, and that has now become, for his movement, sort of one of the cores of their identity, is that they don't have to wear a mask. Some will say it's because it makes them look weak. Some will say that it causes CO2 poisoning or something. They're going to great lengths to justify not wearing it. When you talk about the macho nature of these fascist leaders, were you surprised that he would refuse to do the bare minimum to not be exposed to potentially fatal illness?
Not at all, because this is par for the course, as you point out. Jair Bolsonaro on March 24th, it gave a speech in Brazil where he said, Italy is an old nation, an aging nation. We in Brazil are a strong, young nation. And I, since I was an athlete, this will just be a small cold to me. So, and obviously Brazil is now, their healthcare system is completely overwhelmed. Their hospitals are not taking ICU patients anymore. This is par for the course. It's hard to see Putin, it's hard to see many of these leaders who base themselves in this macho, infallible image, and that is the mark of a fascist leader, that you're infallible. That's why reality is such a threat. Yeah. So they're going to present themselves as infallible.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it could cost a lot of people their lives, because if your movement is going to be saying, we need to get back out there as soon as possible, but then you link that with, and also we need to consider even the most minimal protective equipment an affront to our constitutional rights, that seems like a deadly mix. But finally, I wanted to ask you, I know that we mentioned that the new edition of your book, the soft cover, is coming out. I know that you have a new preface. Could you tell us a little bit about that, about who wrote it and what it covers?
I wrote it, and it covers what has happened since the publication of the book in September 2018, and I wrote it in 2017. And now, how much we can look at what's happened to see that whether the frame of the book in terms of fascist politics and rhetoric, how much that has predicted the subsequent events. Mm-hmm. So I talk about the pandemic. I talk about the science denial that is part of this politics. I talk about the attack on journalists worldwide, the attack on the press that is happening in India, in Brazil, in the United States, the way that Trump has unleashed authoritarians everywhere by not pressing for things like rights. And I talk about the attack on our own rule of law, how the Republican Party has increasingly become a loyalist party, the party of one singular figure, how our norms of what is acceptable for politicians have just shifted by the minute. Yeah. And all of this is predictable.
Yeah, I'm sure he's probably, since the original publication of the book, I'm sure he's given you enough material for a full other book. But everybody, the book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Soft cover will be available just a few days after this video comes out. And Jason Stanley, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.